Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wobbler.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How are you doing?
Good.
And DJ Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy. Are we Gingham buddies again?
Oh, my God.
It's hard to see because... I'm back on the Skype, but this is a small check from back during the era that we were matching powder blue and brown together.
Got it.
So it's a little dated.
All right, you're rocking a Tattersall then. Okay.
Every week we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week I want you guys to tell me what has made you laugh the hardest on YouTube. Oliver.
Robot fails, which I think it probably showed up in my Facebook feed someplace, and it's just a series of videos of robots not doing what we ideally want robots to do. And the one that I think might be the funniest in the batch is one that it's a beer pouring robot. So you put like a can of beer in its hand and its arm, and it tilts it and it's supposed to pour it. And everything that could possibly go wrong. And this robot somehow has impeccable comic timing. Like the comic timing and its FFs are fantastic. And me and my wife were watching it and just giggling like a bunch of morons sitting on the couch.
Is this the one with the ketchup?
This also has that's another great one.
And the robot that starts humping the floor.
Maybe. That sounds about right, too.
I've seen that.
Yeah.
Margaret, is it so wrong if they've learned to love?
Exactly. We've programmed them that way.
Winner, what has made you laugh the most from YouTube?
There's this video called, it's a Vine compilation, but it started with a scene from Dexter with one of the characters' names is James Doakes, and I guess he shows up on Dexter and goes, "Surprise, motherfucker." And then all of these other people recreate that exact framing of the scene with different props, and it's like, "Hard eyes, motherfucker. All rise, motherfucker. Large fries, motherfucker." But it's like, you just have to see it. Like, you will understand once you see it. But I just love the word motherfucker, and I love people's creativity.
You also love that Vine rhythm.
Yes, I love the Vine rhythm. It speaks to me.
I have a question for our social media strategist, which is, how long can Vine sustain itself as a thing? Because it is such a particular medium that...
I think it can go on for quite a while, because as long as they innovate the platform, it will like help sustain all of that. But I just can... Literally, I don't watch late night television anymore. I just watch like 30 minutes of Vines, and I feel like really satiated.
Oh, wow.
Oliver, I question the fundamental premise of your question. Vine is the new opera. It's timeless.
Whoa. For micro, micro, micro attention spans.
Margaret, what about you?
There's this BuzzFeed video that made me cry laughing recently. Basically because
what snacks from other lands are they eating?
That's, of course, what it is. But it's better than most of those other videos, okay? It's the best one because it's the grossest one. They're all eating this Swedish fermented fish.
Oh, I've seen that one.
Yes. And there's one guy in there who's wearing a tank top who just, like, retches every time he smells it or even talks about it, and it's ridiculous and hilarious. And it's just one of those videos where the timing is really impeccable in terms of like just showing everyone's shock face while they're smelling or eating this. It's great.
I went into this planning on answering Cola Scola doing a sketch as his character, Joyce, who is a very upbeat suicidal woman. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized there's this video called Charlotte Says No with like an 18-month-old in the bathtub after a long car trip. And the word that she knows how to say is no. And she's just so excited to be saying it. And her parents are asking, "Do you love us? No. Do you love grandma? No." And it just like... it makes me grow spirit ovaries and just giggle and be excited and want to have a baby.
That can all be arranged for you in this new modern time, Guy. Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Widepath and the MaxFun Reddit for that question. We'll put up links to all those videos up on MaximumFun.org and in the Facebook group. Coming up on this week's show, Clueless is 20. You are all old.
Yeah, pretty much.
But, I mean... now that we are in our golden years, we have to step back and ask ourselves the important questions like, what are the best high school movies? Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment, news, or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about?
I got really into watching Brie Newsome's short film this week called Wake. I always think it's interesting when someone from like the activist community just suddenly pops up into your world, right? Like she took down the Confederate flag from the South Carolina Capitol grounds. And I started following her on Twitter and I really like her Twitter account. Like she's just very insightful. She's really thoughtful. She just brings up like great points to all of the sort of Black Lives Matter protest sphere right now. And so I just was curious about her. So I went onto her website and I watched Wake, which is a short film she made while she was at NYU. And she won a bunch of prizes for it. And it's really strong and very, it's this sci-fi mythical film set in like the 30s or 40s in the South. And wow. I mean, that is like something you just don't hear every day. And the performance, I also have like a soft spot for student films. I just feel like it's just this pure, joyful filmmaking. And so it's kind of low budge, you know, it has like some rough edges about it, but the performances are really strong. It keeps making turns as a movie that you don't expect, which I think is so key, of course, to keep you engaged as a viewer. And I just really loved it.
Brie Newsome is just one of those figures where she pops up and you're like, okay, she can't be this great. Like she can't keep it going. She's gonna, because also you're watching somebody as they're getting like that taste of fame and the aggrandizement that goes along with it. And you keep waiting for them to sort of like get drunk on it. And she's just been so consistently awesome and wonderful. And also, the experience of like going into an internet hole and learning about somebody's work and background is always so fun. When we did the special Max Fun episode where we like interviewed each other, I got like I went into the place of like reading your short fiction, and that was so much fun to just like see the other creative side of someone you've only seen as an analyst, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Brie, it's like she's out there right now mostly as an activist. That's her public face. But to go into her work just added a whole depth to her, you know, activism, her protests. And like you were saying, her Twitter, even though she's gotten all this fame lately, her Twitter is like, you can tell she's a grounded person. Like she is really like staying balanced through all this. You know what I mean? It can be easy to have all that attention on you and suddenly kind of like lose your
scope. It was a conscious decision what she did. She was really
planned out.
She was very planned out, and we never got a chance to really talk about it, but she did that in possession of herself, knowing that whatever happened is going to happen and I'm going to deal with whatever the
she gets down and she's like, sure, go ahead and arrest me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Having a civil rights moment that wasn't the result of a victimization, but was somebody making an affirmative choice. What's been awesome is the way that that has sort of like bounded out into the world of art. Like my friend Rebecca Cohen is a comic artist who did Brie Newsome as Wonder Woman. And then there's this whole world of fan art about Brie Newsome that's just, it's all really exciting. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So I've been dying to talk about True Detective with everyone here.
We've been trying to stop it.
Except I realize that I'm the only... I mean, Guy, you're not watching the show, right?
I am not.
Yeah, so I'm the only one of us four. Apparently, we are not into the prestige dramas anymore here on Pop Rocket. I'm the only one watching season
two.
That's
not that one.
I was telling Margaret earlier that, in general, I'm not a big fan of the whole concept of hate-watching anything. Like, you should watch with some level of affection, even if you want to be critical of it. But I think I might make an exception for True Detective because every subsequent episode seems to, if not get worse, at the very minimum, it doesn't get better. And I keep waiting for the show to make any kind of turn where I'm thinking, okay, the dialogue was at least a little better this episode. The characters are better developed. Something interesting happens. And instead, we're now five episodes deep. So we're more than halfway through the season. And it sort of makes me, I think it's making a lot of people question whether the praise that was given to the first season of the show is really so well deserved, and maybe what we thought was great about that show was really the two lead actors and everything else around it. I mean, I actually think Carrie did a fantastic job directing, because this new season has it's every two episodes I think they switch directors, and there's just sort of a lack of consistency there that's to me subtle, but there's just that the kind of directorial magic and just getting sucked into the world that was created in season one is not happening in season two, even though it's set in Los Angeles, and theoretically this is, should be something I'd be really invested in. But their sense of L.A. is, let's just have a bunch of helicopter shots to the freeways and run that segue about like 15 times per episode.
Oh.
And I mean, they got three episodes left. Things are kind of ramping up. The chess pieces are set up. Maybe there's some kind of like fantastic narrative endgame. But I think Nick Polizanka, Nick P. I'm just going to call him Nick P. I think he's going to take a lot of hits for the success of season one. It probably wasn't due to him. And if people thought that he had issues with women last season, like, holy shit with this season. I mean, it's just his female characters, with the exception of Rachel McAdams, and that's only barely, I think, scraping by relative. But the other secondary female characters are just terrible. So
terrible how?
Just hate-worthy. Like, he makes really, really dislikable mother figures, girlfriend figures, wife figures, Hollywood actress figures. I mean, episode five, which just aired this past week, there were multiple times where you could easily have seen one of the characters slugging one of the other women in the series, because they make them so dislikable that as a viewer, you kind of want to see them get hurt, which is sort of, I mean,
that's a disturbing place to be
in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oliver, two questions, one small, one big. First of all, have you ever watched a season of American Horror Story?
I have not.
All right. Well, if you want lack of consistency and shit showiness,
exactly.
You go to Ryan Murphy.
Yes, he is the grand doyen.
Do you think, like, two-parter, A, how do you feel like 10-episode seasons are giving us more of a chance to have consistent stories in dramas, or does it mean that bad episodes just stink even worse? And do you think that we have a quicker cycle for jumping the shark, that so many shows two or three seasons in are just losing it?
Mm. Well, for one, number one, this show is actually only 8 episodes, so it's actually even shorter than that. And I generally like that, partly because it creates this very nice, compact narrative that you don't have to overinvest, you know, as opposed to, let's say, a show that has like 23 episodes over the course of a season. You just get 8, and you know within those 8 episodes, the story in theory is going to have a beginning, a middle, and the end, and you can kind of look forward to how that gets developed. And again,
but Cagney and Lacey used to be able to just take a break, bust a drug kingpin, not have to worry about NARC.
I'm sorry, and what was the second part? So I don't think there's anything. I don't think that the shorter season, there's anything that's inherently more challenging with it in terms of its ability to deliver on narrative.
Maybe maybe that show, it just relies so much on shock value.
Yeah.
Like, here's really repugnant characters, and that's supposed to shock us to some degree, but that's not a story necessarily. Like, what is the story?
Right.
Yeah.
And when you look back at the first season, I just still don't know what the story was.
Right.
Like, I got to the end, and it was like this sort of mythological blow up that happened, and I just couldn't put the pieces together. That's what made me not watch the second season, is that ultimately I got to the end of all this build up. In the first season, it just went nowhere to me.
And sorry, Guy, what was your second question?
Second part of my question was just the accelerated jumping the shark. Like, I personally am just so mad at House of Cards right now, and so many other shows that had like really nice potential, and then like even kind of Orange is the New Black, and like lost the thread.
I mean, to me, I think it's just really hard to write a television show. You know, if it was so easy to knock it out of the park every season, then no show would ever jump the shark and fail.
I think most shows have been able to sort of know their character structure, know how to tell a story, and have done it successfully until we got to this millennium.
So then what changed then?
Having too many channels on television, having too much competition, paying people too much money to stay. So trying to cut down the amount you have to pay someone.
I think not all stories are meant to go on for 3, 4, 5, 7 seasons.
They don't do that in England. They don't do it in England.
Also, going from, I mean, there is something cool about going towards a more British style, like shorter seasons, but we also went from a world where 20 people wrote these 22 episodes in a season to like 5 people writing the 10 episodes in a season. And there are ways that it's good. We have this much stronger sense of a like guiding force writer producer whose like taste and flavor needs to be in every episode. But I think that people burn out. Like, a lot of people like to shit on Matt Weiner for putting his name on every episode. but he did kind of maintain a consistent tone throughout that entire series.
I mean, with True Detective, I think what this season really is highlighting is that as much credit as Nick P was given for creating the show, he perhaps really isn't the driving force behind what makes it watchable. And he's not a great writer, and he can't figure out how to tell a story in a way that can either pay off with season one or, in this case, just cohere. I mean, this thing is so much all over the place.
And everyone is saying that. It's not like just you.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like it's a huge community. Yeah, like, yeah. Overwhelmingly.
I've seen people, like 2 out of 20 people say they're enjoying it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And I think that the premise of True Detective, which I thought was going to be what they were going to do with season one, which is that you change the primary writer and you change the director every season, that could pay off. I mean, that's risky, but that could be really, really interesting.
That'd
to bring
be way
in.
Better.
Yeah. But it's Nick's show, and I get why he wants to maintain control of it. But I think the show this season has suffered because of that.
Winner, what are you all about this week?
I saw Trainwreck last night, which was literally like, this is your life. It was so like on the nose to about what everything that I'm experiencing that I was a little embarrassed at a few of the things that occurred. Because once you see it, when you see somebody else doing it, and especially some quote-unquote basic white girl, it was just like, it was like, okay. But I took notes while I was watching the movie because these are my notes. Tilda Swinton, amazing. Tilda Swinton's character, her transformation, she's just, God, she's the best at everything.
Who would expect Tilda Swinton to be in this movie?
I know.
And she did a lot of comedy? I'm trying to think of other stuff that she's done.
She has. Yeah, she was in that Wes Anderson movie.
Okay. Who does she play in this?
She plays...
Off-brand Miranda Priestly. Like, it's attempted Devil Wears Prada.
Yes.
But without the writing there.
Right.
But her performance kills it.
Her performance kills it. Because, Apatow loves to put these, like, authoritative figures, like bosses in a lot of these movies. There's always like a boss character who's just aggressive and just loves being a boss. So she takes that trope and just goes like way deep with it. She's amazing. There's a lot of vulnerability in the movie. She and Bill Hader's character kind of fall in love quickly. She's like an avowed like single girl who's not getting married, who's just gonna party, who's just gonna like hook up and not really be into it if you're hot for a relationship, doesn't expect it because her dad tells her at the beginning of the movie, monogamy is for dummies. He beat it into them real young. So
I felt like the script was a little unfocused. I didn't know whether that was because they shot too much and were trying to sort of like cram it into the time. Also, it was 2 hours and 5 minutes, but it was fun the whole time.
Okay, it was 2 hours and 15 because that's you have to ask when you're going to buy the tickets, how long is this movie going to be when it comes to Apatow? Because I need to settle in for what I'm going to deal with. So it was 2:15, which is pretty good for him.
He will give us 3 hours of This Is 40.
If he wanted to. But the thing is I love how he champions women. I thought she was... It wasn't like she was refreshing. I went with one of my best friends, Erica, and she was like, it would just be so great if we had like a black girl on that screen. And I'm like, I get it, but just even to show someone so messy, because she is messy, but she's good at what she does. And she really likes, enjoys her life, but she has a little bit of some like these demons that she really needs to deal with. After a certain point, I think the best question of the entire movie was, when is a good time to stop?
Stop being single, like Samantha-esque person from Sex and the City.
Exactly. You can be that way, but like how sarcastic is sarcastic? Like how much can you just not be so Billy badass that you don't have emotions about anything?
Has Schumer arrived with this film?
Yes. I mean, if you're talking about in the colloquial sense, like, is she now a big star? Yeah. She's a big
star. She's very charismatic. Also, you guys, I crapped out for just a second in there. I did want to clarify, Marina Frank, when you were saying it would be awesome if we had a black girl on that screen in the same way, I just wanted to point out that Marina Franklin, who's a very funny black New York comic, as well as many other female comics from New York are in the film because Amy Schumer is just so great about backing other female comics and giving them a chance. And it isn't like, it certainly isn't having a black female comic star and have this kind of voice, but it is.
But they're
at least
getting
cool.
closer. I mean, there was a lot of black people in this movie. There was a lot of basketball players who were notoriously terrible. LeBron was great, though.
Okay.
I will give LeBron it. He like really played this role where it was about him being LeBron James, but being the LeBron James that you would probably think that he would be, just not like this flat. He's a family man, you know, he cares about his fitness, cares about, you know, so that sort of ties into the whole movie. But
John Cena was the best.
John Cena was, because I've literally dated guys like that. He's just like this meathead with like a really soft heart, but like totally dumb as fucking rocks.
Well, also
great body.
Professional wrestlers just have an advantage when it comes to making the jump to being an actor, because they've been acting the whole time.
That is an advantage.
Whoa.
You're going to get hurt now.
No, I kind of like that, because we could have an whole entire episode about who are the best wrestling actors of the last 100 years. Because, I mean, let's be honest. Roddy Rod Piper. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
Dwayne?
So winner.
Dwayne the Rock.
Oh, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah, Rock wins.
The Rock.
Rock.
He's good people. I wanted to ask you, though, do you feel like the film is a critique of the whole post-feminist idea that, like, we don't need a man and like,
no,
we
because
can sleep around and screw just like a man and doesn't matter?
Well, that's sort of what they addressed in the movie, which I can kind of totally relate to. But at the same time, it showed that you can be that woman. But there's a certain point that society just starts thinking you are just inherently messy. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't even do that, even if you're not projecting that on a day-to-day basis and you make, like, you know, situations better for yourself and you improve your outlook or you're more vulnerable, it's a personal thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that at this point, it felt like she was sort of saying, listen, I can be all that, but I need to learn how to settle down and open myself up.
Like,
and
make a connection.
Yeah, well, that was really the heart of the movie, is that she needs to learn how to make a connection because her dad messed her up.
My all about this week is actually related to yours. Do you remember the larger drunk housewife from the baby shower scene?
Yes.
Yes. So good.
So good.
That is Bridget Everett, who is...
Wasn't she in Sex and the City, too?
Yes. Okay. Here's the story on Bridget Everett. She's just this woman who was on the cabaret scene in New York forever. An amazing voice, but just sort of a body that didn't fit into the Broadway theater's understanding of what they could use. And over time, she developed this cabaret act where she let more and more of herself out. And Comedy Central, God knows what's going on over there, they decided to put a mid-40s Zoftig woman barely wearing clothes on their network for Bridget's special Gynecological Wonder that debuted on July 11th. And it is her singing these songs, what I gotta do to get a dick in my mouth. She has a song about how beautiful all of the different kinds of titties are.
Oh, I love her.
And if anyone ever gets a chance to see Bridget in person, it is better. It is an ocean of performance coming at you. She is so alive and so present. It's amazing. And that will be limited in film, but you did get things like her house band at Joe's Pub is led by Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys.
Amazing. I love that.
All of her celebrity fans came and did cameos for the special. It was so great. But to behave as though what is important about this is Adam Horowitz or Sarah Jessica Parker or anything else is to fail to respect that Bridget Everett is just, like, A, has an amazing voice, but B, is just one of the best comedic performers that who we have right now. And it's this woman who was working as a waitress 4 years ago.
That's like, amazing.
To see everyone sort of come together and say, this talent is too great, it must be respected. It really is super great. And on a lesser note, but part of Comedy Central's being aware that half of the population has 2X chromosomes, the show Another Period is something that I wrote on. And it is a sitcom that is kind of like Downton Abbey meets the Kardashians. And if anyone listening feels like watching it on
what
Tuesdays,
time you need to
I'm watching it and I find it delightful.
Oh, it's, thank you.
Yeah, it's very funny.
It's Tuesday at 10:30 after Inside Amy Schumer.
And why don't you tell everybody what the hashtag is?
Oh, what it's hashtag another period, right?
Okay, great.
I don't know. Margaret, it was the most fun show to work on ever. I got to pitch a story. It did not make it into the show. About hatpin legislation as a metaphor for abortion rights.
Yeah, I love how many Easter eggs you guys leave in those jokes. Like, there's yes. so many tiny little details that are hilarious.
Okay, right. Wait. Other thing really fast is you guys have to watch Odd Mom Out.
What's that?
It's so good, and just trust me. Okay. It's on Bravo.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
You guys saw the poster for it.
It's really good.
And the poster made it look terrible. So.
Yeah, I know. Okay. It's like crazy good. Okay. I'm so sorry. And Guy... just Wappler. I don't know about you, Oliver, but you're not going to like it, but you two are going to love it.
All right.
We need to stop patriarchy bashing Oliver. This has gone too far. You're listening to Pop Rocket. Shh, quiet. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Dave Holmes, and if you've been missing my show, International Waters, you've been missing this.
If there's one thing I know about owls, yes. they We've are wise. Changed. Two things. They are wise.
Yes.
They love nightclubs.
They wear tiny graduation motorboards, and they love nightclubs.
They also do the best double takes of all birds of prey.
And if you slow it down, they actually go, get it up.
International Waters, a panel show where U.S. and U.K. comedians battle for pop culture supremacy. Subscribe right now on iTunes or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum, in New York, in my apartment. But in the studio, there are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wong.
Wong?
Yeah. I'm switching it up.
Okay.
We are all allowed to change and grow because we are all very, very old. 20 years ago this week, America met a regular All-American sophomore, I believe sophomore, at Bronson Alcott High, Cher Horowitz, and we have not been the same as a people since. Clueless stands out as one of the great high school movies. Iconic, magical, but also stunningly grounded. Margaret Wappler, my question for you. This movie is silly. It makes teen plastic surgery and sculpture collections a part of a teenager's life. Why is it so relatable?
I think this movie is so relatable because it captures this moment in time where it was basically the slacker identity meets the millennial optimism.
Mm.
I really think that, like, Josh represents her stepbrother, represents the slacker, you know, reading Nietzsche by the pool, like, you can't do anything frivolous and light, you must always be saving the world. All these concerns about what selling out is, all of that is from the slacker Generation X kind of time.
Marky Mark taking time out of his pants dropping schedule to help plant trees.
That was a bizarre, like, character break, in my opinion. I don't think he would have said that. But at any rate, Alicia Silverstone represents the other side where she is, like, you know, sort of the optimist. She's the millennial kid. Like, she, you know, embraces the mall. She embraces consumerism. She mm-hmm. embraces having fun. So I think it really encapsulates that moment in time in the 90s that everyone was wrestling with. Like, what do you, who are you going to be? Are you, and that's such a high school thing, too. Like, mm-hmm. who are you going to be? Are you going to be the sellout? Are you going to be the poet in an army jacket? Are you going to be the cheerleader? All of those things, I think, still stay with us. The, you know, even when we're 30, 40, 50 years old, these identities that we formed in high school and first started thinking of ourselves as these identities will stay with us all of our lives.
But it's so heightened. I don't understand how it is. It feels as homey as it does when it's as heightened as it is.
You know, I think it's partially about the charm of the performances in the movie. I mean, I had forgotten sort of what Alicia Silverstone was all about. And Stacey Dash, too. And Brittany Murphy. I mean, yeah. Brittany Murphy is adorable in this movie. And I'd sort of forgotten all about her charm. And so I think a lot of it is just bringing this certain lightness into the popular crowd. That idea of the popular kids actually being nice kids still. Which is the polar opposite of what, like, Heathers established, right?
Well, like, John, I feel like John Hughes did us a disservice by creating this very, very, like, rigid caste system of high school cliques, and it doesn't respect like that there is some degree of permeability or at least relationship between them.
Yes.
Oliver, it's also a super LA movie. But again, I keep going back to this issue of relatability, that it doesn't feel like 90210. It doesn't feel like, oh, look at this, it's Beverly Hills. It just feels like a kind of magical world where a very human story is going on. Why?
I mean, I don't know if that was purposeful or if they were consciously trying not to do the same things that you saw in 90210 as a television series or in other films. Or television shows that have been set in Beverly Hills around that same era. You know, the things about Clueless that really stand out to me are some of the inside jokes that I thought were funny. I mean, especially the one where Stacey Dash doesn't want to get onto the freeway, which I, as someone who grew up in L.A., didn't actually make any sense to me because freeways were kind of how you were mobile in L.A. So the idea that you wouldn't want to get on it, intrinsically, I didn't connect to. But maybe that's because I didn't grow up in Mid-City.
Well, everything that she wanted to do was already in Beverly Hills.
Yeah,
you know
maybe,
I mean?
Maybe.
Everywhere in L.A. takes 20 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Total inside joke.
Total.
Which now feels romantic because now it's like 45.
Right.
You can't get anywhere in 20 minutes.
I mean, Jesus. And I really believe that when I moved here, too.
Right.
I held on to that for like at least until like 2004.
You were shaped by Clueless.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so I do think that it is an interesting L.A. film. It you know, it'd be interesting to compare it with other films in that same era that are looking at L.A. through both a lens that's kind of familiar. In other words, we've seen depictions of this before, but it's not necessarily trying to replicate the same, I think, as guys, you were saying, like sort of this fetishization of the wealth of Beverly Hills or that part of L.A. I mean, you certainly see parts of that, obviously, like her stepdad or father, I should say. I mean, he's in a mansion and et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't feel like they're kind of hammering you over the head with her kind of class privilege, even though it's a part of the film that you can't excise from it. But
she just takes it for granted. She just takes her world so for granted. The thing I think is most hilarious is the mall technology that was cutting edge mall technology there. That realizing that she goes to the West Side Pavilion and acts like that's cute.
Where like was the Beverly Center? Was it not around yet?
No, they go to the mall that they show is the West Side Pavilion. But
which is a sad mall. So, yeah.
But they also do show her at that Palazzo thing in Beverly Hills. What do you call it? With the steps?
Oh, yes. 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 Right there off the end of Rodeo Drive in Wilshire.
Right.
Okay. Winner. Why does this movie not get old? Why is it timeless?
I think that it doesn't get old because it was totally 1995. In 1995, I feel like that was – I don't know what the shift was because I was 15 and super in my head at this point. But I think the internet. I think the internet beginning, being at its very early stages, really started opening us up to knowing a little bit more about other people and how they lived and what they thought about. I think a little bit more. Because if you think about all the movies we had beforehand that were high school-y, it was like very localized and that's, we only knew what you saw on there, but there wasn't like sort of a way to like get to it. And I felt like being able to have more conversations and having these websites and more community, what is it called? The message board, messaging each other. You can like learn more about what people are doing. But I also,
when you think about high school movies that came afterwards, like Can't Hardly Wait or She's All That, like those feel so much more dated. I think that there's also an element of like just how stylized Clueless is makes it less 1995 and a little bit more just Clueless.
No, you know? But it's like a Polaroid. Like it was a perfectly framed Polaroid because the fashion, the music, the slang that they used, jeepin', like they created words like jeepin'. And then I remember thinking when I first heard that, I was like, jeepin'? And then I only thought like you only did it in a Jeep. Anyway, like there was a lot of, and also the fact that everybody in her crew was a different kind of person. There was a lot of diversity. There was a lot of, you know, like her best friend is this black girl, but they're like, they would give each other sass. I liked how they would sass each other.
But they never talked. There wasn't like the plot line about Stacey Dash being black. Do you know what I mean?
No, right.
Which was, I thought, cool. Like just that it's like, this is the world.
Yeah.
And it was an integrated part of her world. Like she talked about like different qualities of fake hair. It's not as though this were just a white guy writing something and had no understanding of what it was to be a black woman. But she was just an integrated part of that world with an authentic black perspective. Also, we need to respect Stacey Dash. However Fox News she is now, she gave us something beautiful back then.
She did give us something beautiful, but that was like it. So I can't give her too much credit. And she's still riding that Clueless wave, eating off Clueless.
She was 47 years old when they made that movie. I realize it's more like 27, but still. She had limited time left. All right, Oliver,
yeah.
you have very strong opinions. Okay, we're now going to determine once and for all what the greatest high school movie of all time is.
No, we're not. Impossible.
I'm joking.
Okay.
But Oliver's going to set some parameters.
No, I think I was probably hammering this point a little too hard in our pre-show discussion, which is I think there's definitely a subgenre of Hollywood films that are teen films and then there are high school films. And while those two things crossover all the time, to me, if we're using Clueless as sort of the kind of the entry point into that conversation, I think that, you know, we should keep it focused on high school films. And there's, you know, a handful, probably more, less than I think I originally realized, of films that are about people who are high school age, but the setting is in high school and it's not really about the social relationships that and hierarchies that are created in high school. And for me, I was just thinking, as a way of limiting the discussion, is keeping us focused, we should sort of exclude what those things are. But for example, you know, the one example I was using was Say Anything. But the more I thought about it, I mean, the first probably 30 minutes are really still set in a high school environment, even if most of the rest of the film is them on some vacation. It's outside of that environment. But yeah, Say Anything still, I think, qualifies as a high school film. Whereas I think Boys in the Hood, for example, definitely a teenage film, but school's not, and the dynamics of school are not a really big part of it. So I would not consider Boys in the Hood to be a high school film, even though it is a definitive, like, youth film. Now, in contrast, if we want to talk about Dope, which is this summer's, you know, that people compare that to Boys in the Hood. That is definitely a high school film because the high school dynamics are a big part of it.
I still think with Boys in the Hood, I mean, we talked about that a bit.
Boys in the Hood?
Boys in the Hood.
I've never seen that version.
That was how it was released. Yeah, it was released in Israel, like Boys in the Hood.
I still think that high school was this shadow looming over the whole dynamic between the boys. It was like, who's going to go off in what direction?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, who's going to go to college on the scholarship? Who's going to end up staying in the neighborhood? So I still feel like it's this, even though it's not treated that important, it is important in the dynamic of the movie.
There's that discussion his parents have, Angela Bassett and Lawrence Fishburne, they have in the cafe about what are they going to do with him. What they have that discussion even at the beginning of the movie, like, he can't be in this neighborhood. I don't want him to die. He needs you.
Yeah.
He needs to get out. He's in school smarter than everyone else. He's going to need to be, you know, you to guide him and to focus on that. Like, the school, I disagree. I feel like it's a teen movie, but it's still part of the dynamic.
Yeah. But it's not a high school film.
Why not?
Because it doesn't take place in a high school. It's about South LA. It's a film about a neighborhood.
Well,
it's not a film about a school. And those are two different environments.
Okay, just so when I Googled teen high school movies, it totally came up in the search bar.
Right, and I'm being didactic about this, but I don't think it belongs there. But this is not an
either or. I think that it is a tonal question. And like, there is a way that a high school movie like rests on this extremely structured environment. When you look at the sheer number of like really successful high school movies that are adaptations of Shakespeare, or I mean, we always forget that like Clueless is an adaptation of Emma. It's working within this very, very strict world of class consciousness. You know, 10 Things I Hate About You, which is maybe my favorite high school movie.
Which is shocking.
Taming of the Shrew. Why? It's so good.
I haven't seen it.
It's my sister's favorite. I love Fast Times.
Clearly not yours, though.
No. Fast Times
makes me so uncomfortable.
Why?
I don't want a high school movie to have an abortion in it. I don't want, and like, it's...
They covered a lot of ground in that entire year. So much happened in that 1 year.
Wait, but why don't you want that to have?
That's happened.
I realize that it is rooted in reality. It's too real. Like, it's not fun enough.
You want the fantasy.
But then why did everybody like Juno?
Because it was heightened.
That was a central plot point, right? Her pregnancy. It wasn't like a second. I don't agree with Guy. I think it's okay to have an abortion in a high school film, but they're two different films, though.
Fast Times is more than that. Fast Times is is that 1970s treating 13-year-olds like they should be doing cocaine and having sex, like maturity bleeding into 1980s high school movies. And it like also watching it when I was like 14 or 15, it just made me so uncomfortable.
Yeah, Fast Times also doesn't make a great case for like girls being empowered either. You know what I mean? Like there's some uncomfortable scenes of like girls just making out in ways that you don't feel like they really want to.
Linda was pretty empowered.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, like,
Phoebe Cates' character.
I get your point in that not every moment of Fast Times is like a comfortable watch, you know.
But I don't think it was intentional.
I think that's good. You know, like it's good to see that kids like have these uncomfortable, awkward moments.
Yeah, I feel like most high school films are built about awkward moments.
Right.
Otherwise, why would you set it in high school?
Yeah.
So, Guy, what are your favorites?
I love 10 Things I Hate About You. I love Election.
Election's so good.
Soft Place in My Heart for She's the Man, and Mean Girls. I'm a big Mean Girls fan. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Heathers, of course.
It's so weird because Ferris Bueller is probably one of my most favorite movies about high school because, one, my mom always felt like that was her and her best friend. She felt like she was Cameron and her best friend was Ferris because they would always get into stuff in high school. And then it was cool to see like the cool kid. Like he took risks that entire day and they paid off because he just wanted to have just a day off. And
Margaret,
I don't know why. It's a really strong film.
Margaret, have you ever read Atwood's Cat's Eye?
Yeah, it's been forever though.
But it's very much like Ferris Bueller in that it's at the core is one of those relationships between a fundamentally cautious person and a fundamentally sort of like out there daring person in teenage years. And I feel like that's such an evocative relationship. Mm-hmm. It's a relationship that so many of us can easily identify with, that person who seemed willing to take all of the chances and scared you and excited you more than anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, when you're in high school, your best friend is so important. That
right.
person's molding your world. That person maybe goads you into doing something you didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. You maybe goad her. I mean, I don't know if there's a high school movie that doesn't have the best friend dynamic. I mean, that's pretty much the tribal dynamic of high school is so important.
Mm-hmm.
What are your favorites, Margaret?
I love Mean Girls too. I think it's great. It's
still
sorry.
What is a sequel?
I was just joking. Like they made a sequel.
Oh,
sorry.
They did make a direct-to-video sequel that only gay guys watch. Yeah.
It was only released to gay men. it still makes me a little sad to see that movie and to see Lindsay Lohan and what could have been. But
we ever watched
anyway.
Parent Trap? I definitely get that watching the Parent Trap.
No, I have. Oh God, she's even younger in that.
Yeah,
right?
And she's really good in it. And it's sort of like, oh man, this is a. It's great, and then you get bummed out for the same reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I love Mean Girls. I love Heathers. That was probably, for me, like the biggest teen movie. I also love Pretty in Pink. Pretty in Pink has scenes that crack me up in terms of like Molly Ringwald's like stomping on the floor, overacting. Also, the moment where she makes her own prom dress, and it's absolutely
best.
A horror show
that
as a dress.
Is so ugly.
It's
a trapezoid.
Why do I love that dress so much?
You're like the only person.
What?
Well.
Then we can talk about Vanessa Bayer's jumpsuits all in Trainwreck.
Oh, okay.
Those are wonderful though.
Oh, jumpsuits shit. I love. This whole
I thought
like
you guys would be up
this
with
whole
me that
triangle
those were hideous.
At the neckline
I
thing
love that.
Was a mistake.
But Margaret, and you're from Chicago.
Yes.
And you're around my age, God forbid. But like John Hughes felt like it's such a structured view of high school that defined what I thought high school was going to be like.
Yep.
And so they're both very like satisfying movies because they remind me of childhood and watching them on TBS. But they're also they just feel so constrained.
Yeah, I agree. There's something about the template of those movies that felt really controlled, and that when I was watching Clueless, I really felt like, oh, this feels a little more like high school. Maybe because I went to a very big high school and the high school in Clueless is also really big. And I think when you go to a big high school, like some of those social ideas about like who's popular, who's the athlete, whatever, break apart a little bit just because there's so many people that there's like 10 different popular groups and there's like 10 different artist groups or whatever. So I don't know. It felt, like Pretty in Pink definitely feels a little like not real world to me, but that's also what I love about it. I mean, I think the sort of minor characters in Pretty in Pink are grab me more. Ducky, the woman who runs
Annie Potts.
Yes, Annie Potts, who runs the record store. Like those characters.
Should she have ended up with like Blaine or Ducky? Because I feel like she should have ended up with Ducky, even though she wasn't going to.
What's
going to
happen is that in like 2 years, she's going to be like, I really should have been with Ducky. Mm-hmm. And he's going to have moved the fuck mm-hmm. on.
mm-hmm. I completely changed my entire answer. As you say this, I realize my favorite high school movie of all time is Dazed and Confused because it gave the most organic view of how a high school actually works with these groups of friends sort of like interchanging with each other and corresponding. It's male-centered but not boring and has Parker Posey making children fry like bacon. That's my final answer. Oliver, what's yours?
I think if the lazy choice would be Grease just because it's fun and I like the songs and it's just,
you're the one that I want.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, young Olivia that's Newton-John
that part.
in that part era going. Was
there's
incredible.
An abortion in that one too.
Wait, there was?
Didn't she have an abortion?
No. There was an intimation that Rizzo was pregnant, but as it turns out, she was just late.
Oh,
but she
that's
wasn't
right.
actually pregnant. But yeah, there was some unintended pregnancy kind of scare happening there. But that's, I mean, Grease is like super easy to choose. To me, the sleeper choice would actually be Brick, which was by Rian Johnson,
nice.
Who is going to be directing one of the standalone Star Wars films coming up. And it was, I think, probably Joseph Gordon-Levitt's breakout post Third Rock from the Sun film, where it's sort of like, oh, he's kind of grown up now and he's doing other stuff. And if you've never seen Brick, the basic conceit of it is a 1940s noir film that is set in a contemporary Southern California high school. So everyone talks in that kind of hard-boiled, pulpy way as if it was out of like a pulp novel, but it's coming out of the mouths of like contemporary teenagers. And all of the characters are basically classic noir archetypes. You have the femme fatale, you have sort of the shadowy bosses, da-da-da-da-da. And I thought it was just a very clever execution on what is, you know, kind of this kind of high concept elevator pitch movie, which is let's set a classic 40s noir in high school and boom, that's the movie in a nutshell. But I think it actually executes really, really well on it.
There is this interesting through line with teen movies where they do borrow more established or more respected genres mm-hmm. to lend some kind of credibility mm-hmm. to their own. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned how Clueless is based on Emma. You know, you're talking about it being based on 40s noir and Brick. You know, and it makes me think about, too, that Romeo and Juliet, that high school movie.
Right.
Do you guys remember that with
Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like just about every Shakespearean play has been rated for teen movie possibilities.
Oh, God. Remember when Julia Stiles couldn't get a job that wasn't that? She made Othello in a high school.
That's right. Oh, my God. That Othello movie. Oh, wow.
It was called that. Oh, my God.
That's right. That was high concept.
Winner, what's your official favorite high school movie?
I would say Heathers. Only because it was dark, and it's sort of like before that it was I really liked Lucas, but it was dark. Well, no, before that it was Teen Wolf.
Lucas.
All right.
Oh yeah.
Wait, what's Lucas?
Lucas is not a teen movie.
It was like Corey Haim.
He's in high school.
Oh, is he?
Yeah,
okay.
He's in high school. Corey Haim and Charlie Sheen and Cary Grant, and Charlie Sheen is like he's like the head of the football team, and he takes on Corey Haim's character like as his little like buddy, and he falls in love with his girlfriend. I love that movie because I loved Corey Haim, but it was Teen Wolf for a really long time because I love the idea of somebody becoming like being the underdog and sort of like finding their coolness and sort of showing the school how cool they're going to be. And then it was ridiculous. He was a werewolf.
At the end of that movie, I remember being so angry that he did not end up with Boof. Just being like,
he did end up with Boof.
There's a character
named
Boof.
They kiss in the stand. Pamela, Boof. They kiss in the stands.
Oh,
he totally ends up with Boof. Yeah, dude.
You're not even trying to name a character. It's Boof just like, what's the sound
no,
of
like,
when your script fell
Boof
off your desk?
Is, I love the scene in Teen Wolf when him and Boof like are supposed to kiss in the closet. And she comes out and she has like her shirt all scraped up because he like got like all excited because he was going to kiss her. And then I also love Styles being his best friend and,
I like a case of beer.
Like buying the beer. And then Heather's, though. Heather's is really, 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 though,
Heather's
my go-to.
Is so good. I can't not watch it if I catch it on TV.
It's so creepy. It's creepy. Dark. It's dark.
And the chaos of that final act, amazing.
Well, you know there's an original final act, right?
No. What's
they were all supposed to blow up. All of them. But that would have been just like the teenage suicide, the whole right. that whole the whole idea that they all think that
she's a spoiler and a half.
Sorry, it's only been out for 30 years. No, the fact that they deify. I always wonder if I say that word or not. Heather, because they think she killed herself and they think it was one of the most noble things, which is why every time me and my girlfriends go, "Oh, the humanity," we say it all the time because. You know, fuck me gently with a chainsaw.
So we need to wrap up, but when
yeah. Do we? Do yes. we need to wrap up?
Well, according to Colin, yes, we do. I want to, since we're talking about Teen Wolf, God. Michael J. Fox, I just read today that
episode.
They are going to re-release Back to the Future in theaters because not only is it the 30th anniversary of that film, which just makes us feel even more old, but also 2015 is when they went into the future. That was in October of 2015.
Oh.
And I am still waiting for the hoverboards and all the other technology that would have supposedly existed now.
It's so weird that we didn't mention that at all.
It's not that good of a high school movie.
Wait a second.
It's more of a 50s movie. All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Racket. We'll be right back after this.
Ty is a pedantic person. I think when he pronounces these words, it's in a very show-offy way. Gyro.
Gyro.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu.
Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with real cases. They call in via Skype to Judge John Hodgman's court, the real people's court. Now I call you to Judge John Hodgman's internet court. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. Over in the studio are...
Oliver Wang.
Margaret Wappler.
Winter Mitchell.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask that age-old question, what's your current jam? Winter Mitchell, what's your jam?
I'm really into this song called, it was really, really hard to find, and unfortunately it's not going to be on Spotify, and it is called Sharpness by Jamie Woon, and I heard it on Other Tone, the amazing Beats One radio show I talked about the other week, and he's an English singer, songwriter, he's got a huge following, is not really prolific on social media, and this was a really hard find. I love this song.
Never been so inside. I'm not giving to you. Never been so existent. You can't know unless you feel it come back. Body's aching from the
I love it. That's all quadrants.
That
on
is
fire.
Smooth.
All quadrants just shooting.
That
and
is like the
go.
Whiskey that puts out the quadrant.
Girl,
fire.
I know. I have visions of how I'm going to entertain this song, so just know that.
Oliver, what's your jam?
This is a song that actually came out a couple of months ago, so I'm just catching up with it now. But it's by The Arcs, and it's called Stay in My Corner, and it's the lead single off of what will be The Arcs album coming out, I think, in early September.
Sounds like the band or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, The Arcs is Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys' side project, and he's working with Leon Michaels of Truth and Soul Records in Brooklyn, one of my favorite retro soul labels. And you know, Michaels has tons of experience leading a band, and him and Auerbach and a bunch of other players are collaborating to write albums worth of songs, and it has this sort of super psychedelic soul feel to it. And I love this tune. I got to give a quick shout out to the folks at Heartbreak Radio, because this is where I heard this song on their podcast and radio show, and I love this. And it the album sounds anything like this, I'm going to be all over that album.
That's a good dreamy summer feel.
It does.
I was going to not have a jam this week because I felt like I had put everyone through enough with the summer jam search.
Oh, by the way, so number one, as the new number one song of the summer right now is Cheerleader.
According to whom?
Billboard.
Okay.
Fuck them.
No, I'm sorry. Seriously, you guys, last week I was making strong arguments for its ever presence and its strong place in summer, and you guys were telling me that I was stupid.
I didn't agree with that.
I got it. I told you guys how I got in my car and it played twice just in my like 10 minute drive, and it horrified me. I'd never even heard it on the radio before. It was like you guys all cursed it. Yeah.
I smell the popular culture. I taste the popular culture.
What does it taste like?
The beating heart of, Pepsi, like that clear Pepsi.
Oh, that is garbage. Pour that out.
Okay. But I did realize that the thing I couldn't stop listening to this week was a song from the musical Fun Home. And I kind of wanted to make you guys listen to Maps, where she talks about how 4 miles from her house was I-80 that connects the Castro and Christopher Street, and how her dad never came out of the closet. But I didn't know if that was charismatic enough. So I'm just going to give you a little girl realizing that she likes girls for the first time. Here's Ring of Keys.
A Sondheim song, you said?
No, this is
it's a B-side and Into the Woods.
Okay.
This is from the musical Fun Home, which is based on a graphic novel by Alison Bechdel about her. She came out of the closet at the beginning of college back in the 80s, and then 4 months later, her dad committed suicide, and her mom revealed to her that her dad had been a closeted gay guy the entire time.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's an adult woman trying to wrap her head around a sense of responsibility and relationship to this story, and the place of her sexuality in it. And it's funny that you say that, Oliver, because Sondheim, gay is all get out, but all of his plays just dance around not being able to actually address it. And the weird awesomeness of just having a 12-year-old girl say out loud on a stage the weird feeling of realizing you're being attracted to something you're not supposed to, and you don't have any of the terms to figure it out, is just awesome. It's really great. People should get the cast album, and if you're in New York, get tickets if you can. Margaret, what is your jam this week?
My jam is the new Peaches song. Peaches is back. If you've never seen Peaches in concert, you really should make the effort to do so, because she will climb rafters, she will hump amps, she will bring on lovely gay boys and dance with them. She's just a total blast to see live. You know, she's been working this whole sort of like electroclash thing forever, and, you know, she finds a way to wring freshness out of it. And I really love this new song that she's got called Light in Places. When she says light in places you didn't know could shine, I'll let you figure out where that might be. Later on in this song, she uses the term stargasm, which I really love as a term, and I just want to wish stargasms for all of our listeners for all of time.
Yes. You know, she just, why isn't she like, especially now, why isn't she like huge? You know what I mean? Like, why isn't she a judge on America's Next Top Model or like Project Runway?
Because
like,
she's too edgy and weird, I think. But maybe
always,
it's
just she's done so many things that people are just straight up copying now.
I mean, I agree. I think maybe this album is going to be the right timing for her. It comes out in September. It's called Rub.
I go to a Peaches concert with you any day of the week.
Done.
I would take it from the airport and go and see it. That's how much I would do
that. The mainstream is not for everyone. Some of us have to live on the cutting edge, Winter. character.
Don't I know it?
You
Don't
have I been listening it. To Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winner Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to The First Echo, Sassy Sparky, and JM Buffy for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. But that's only 3 people who gave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. You guys, get out there. Make it happen.
We need you.
You guys, we were named one of iTunes' best new podcasts for their 10 years of...
Booty who?
I'm going to start charging for autographs.
For their 10 years of podcasting, spectacular, whatever. Get in touch with us.
That was so 90s of you. Whatever.
Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us what has made you laugh the hardest on YouTube. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer, who ate a brain tumor for breakfast, is Colin Anderson.
What happened?
That was a reference to Heathers.
Okay. Oh. Fair.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.